I can't see y'all. Are y'all out there? Hi, I'm an Al-Anon from Hueytown, Alabama. My name's Bo Templin. Hi, y'all. Sure is good to be here tonight. The only way I know to start this thing for you folks that have been here all day is to tell you, like Paul Harvey would say, this is going to be page 3. It's about the only way I know to start it. I would like to do a couple of things here before I crank up, though. One, I want to take just a minute and not only thank the committee for inviting Shirley and Sissy and me here this weekend, because this is an honor and it's a privilege for us to be here. But I'd like to take just a minute and ask you, if you're sitting out there and you've enjoyed this weekend, would you join me in giving the committee a real big round of applause? They've done a great job. I'll tell you, for you folks that maybe haven't been to many of these, I've worked on a few of these things, and by golly, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of hard work that has gone into having this thing here for us this weekend. So thank you, committee. We appreciate that. I don't know why I'm feeling so fidgety, but I just feel fidgety and a little more nervous than usual. But before I go completely off the deep end here, I want to take just a minute and I want to say something to the alcoholics that are sitting in the room with us tonight, because I know we got some in here, because I know you personally. And I'd like to take just a minute and just talk to you specifically, if you're sitting in here and you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight. And what I'd like to say to you is, I'd like to say from the very bottom of my heart, thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you for being there 10 years ago last Wednesday when my gal reached out her hand. Because you see, I'd lost her. I didn't have her anymore. The bottle had her, and I couldn't do anything about it. And when she reached out her hand and she asked for help, you were standing there, and you didn't ask her any question, and you extended the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you took her in, and there wasn't any conditions. You just said, come on in. And I don't know that I'll ever be able to say thank you enough. Because you see, you gave my gal back to me. I got her back today, and it's all because of you, and you were there for her, and I want you to know that I appreciate it. And I want to say thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous, for another reason. Some 15 years after you came about, 15 and a half years, something like that, you said, yeah, come on, Al-Anon, you can have our steps too. Yeah. And you didn't sit on them, and you didn't say we couldn't have them, and you didn't say we weren't privileged to this way of life. You see, you knew that it was a family disease from the start, because when you wrote your book, you put 2 chapters in there. It's directed to the wives and the family afterward. So you knew it was a family disease, and you gave us your 12 steps, and you said, yeah, you can have this way of life too. You know, our beloved co-founder Lois, in some of her writings, made the statement, Alcoholics Anonymous did all the work. We just came along and reaped all the benefits. And I appreciate that. And I don't think we tell you that enough, and especially from the podium tonight. I just want to say thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, when I introduced myself to you, I told you that I was from Hueytown, and I am. I live in Hueytown, but my home group is not in Hueytown. My home group is in Bessemer, Alabama. Now, that's only a distance of about 5 miles. There is a group in Hueytown, Alabama, and both those Al-Anon groups lay claims on me. The Hueytown group claims I belong to Bessemer, and sometimes my home group in Bessemer claims I belong to Hueytown. So you need to know that about me as we share a little bit tonight. I also not only told you where I was from, I told you what I was. I told you that I was an Al-Anon. And I got to stop just a minute and talk a little bit about that. Because you see, there was a period of time around this thing that I thought being married to this real live alcoholic that I got back here made me an Al-Anon. And I know that that's not true today. I know that being married to Shirley does not make me an Al-Anon. It only qualifies me for Al-Anon. And there's several things that I got to do in order to be able to stand up here tonight and tell you that my name is Bo and I'm an Al-Anon. And I want to share three or four of those things with you. And these are things that have been important to me over the past few years. Number one, in order to tell you that I'm an Al-Anon, I got to go to some meetings. Yeah. I got to suit up and I got to show up. I got to be there. But let me tell you now, that's just the beginning. That's just the beginning. Just going to meetings alone won't do it. Okay? You know, I got a buddy up in Cleveland, Ohio, that says it this way. He says, I can walk out the back door every day for 20 years, and I can go out there and I can occupy a chair in the chicken coop. And guess what? Occupying that chair ain't never going to make me a chicken. You see? So there's more to it than just occupying that chair. Okay? There's something called action. We got to get into action with this thing. But let me tell you more about going to meetings. It has become real important to me that I have a home group. Now, first 6 or 7 months that I was around this program, I didn't have a home group. Didn't find it necessary to have a home group. I was going to a lot of meetings. And I was going to meetings over here and over yonder and out there. And I wasn't ever lighting anywhere long enough to let anybody get to know Bo. You see. I'd tell you a little bit, and then I'd tell Greg a little bit, and I'd tell somebody else a little bit, and I wasn't letting anybody get to know Bo. And so you know there wasn't a whole lot going on for Bo. But let me tell you why today it's even more important to me that I have a home group. Because you see, just about 10 years ago when I walked in the doors of Al-Anon in Bessemer, Alabama, the door was open and the hand was extended. Al-Anon was there. And that's an old structured group and it's strong in the traditions. And because it's strong and it's structured and it's in the traditions, that group's going to be there for a while. And as I've been around this program a few years, I've begun to reap a few rewards. I've begun to get a few benefits from this thing. And along with those rewards comes a responsibility. And it's my responsibility to be there in my home group and make sure that the door is open and the hand of Al-Anon is extended for those that are going to come today and tomorrow. And if you don't have a home group, think about what I've just said. What's going to happen 6 months from now when that newcomer walks in? Are we going to be there? Get yourself a home group and get busy. The next thing that I'd share with you is necessary for me to tell you that I'm an Al-Anon is I got to have a sponsor. And I not only got to have a sponsor, I got to utilize that sponsor. Now, I know my sponsor's telephone number. Do you? Do you? I don't have to look in my billfold to get my sponsor's telephone number. It would surprise you how many people do. I don't know where I would be today in this program if it had not been for my sponsors. And if you're new in this program and you don't have a sponsor and you don't understand sponsorship, if you'll see me when this thing is over, I'll share with you my understanding of sponsorship. And if you're new and you don't have one, I would suggest strongly to you that you try to have one before you leave here this weekend. And if you've been around this program a while and you don't have one, shame on you. Shame on you. Yeah. I do believe that there's a special place in heaven for sponsors. I really do. I feel that strongly about it. And the last thing that I would share with you that's necessary in order for me to be able to stand up here tonight and tell you that I'm an Al-Anon, is I got to take those 12 simple steps that we read. 12 simple steps for a very complicated person. And to the best of my ability, I got to incorporate them in my life on a daily basis. Every day, putting one foot in front of the other, doing the best that I can do. Some days I do pretty good with them, some days I don't do so good. But you know, the proof of this thing is in the putting one foot in front of the other and making the effort. Out there making the effort. 12 simple steps for a very complicated person. So these are some of the things that I think is necessary in order for me to stand here tonight and tell you that I'm an Al-Anon. And I share these things with you because it's some of the things that I didn't do early on in this program, and it kept me from growing the way I needed to grow. So I just share that with you for that reason. But I think the real reason I'm here tonight is to share with you a little bit about me. And in order to do that, I have to go back and I have to start it with this simple statement. I was born at a very early age. Now, it's necessary for me to go back and start there because, you see, I was born into what I know today is a real good breeding ground for AA, Al-Anon, and Alateen. I was born into a very strict, very religious Southern Baptist home. Now, what's important for me to share with you about this time in my life is that it was there in that home where I was taken to church Sunday morning and Sunday nights and Wednesday nights in that Southern Baptist church right there in Hueytown that I formed a conception of God that I was going to bring into adulthood with me that was going to cause me some problems. Now, that wasn't the church's fault. It wasn't the preacher's fault. Because I know that back there in that church, they talked to me about God being loving and God being forgiving. But you see, that's not what I chose to remember and bring with me. The conception that I brought into adulthood with me was the conception that God will get you. God's going to get you. And I had him sitting up there, wherever it is that I had him sitting in that great white throne. And he had that big scoreboard up there and Bo's name was on it. And he was keeping tabs on Bo. And when Bo did something good, there was a big check mark. And when I did something bad, there was a big X. And every time the X went up there, there was a price to be paid. And you see, when the disease of alcoholism reared its ugly head in our family, my prayers had become, why me, God? What have I done, God? Why, how is it that you're punishing me so bad? Because you see, I looked on Shirley's drinking as a punishment to me for something that I had done. And I kept demanding of God that he reveal to me what I could do to make this thing right. And, of course, I never got an answer to that prayer. But back to my childhood. Being raised in this good religious home, I wasn't subjected to any drinking. Neither my mother nor my dad drank. I was active in sports. And at that time, if you were playing ball, you didn't drink. You didn't get involved in it several years ago. And so I never was around it, and I never was subjected to it, and I never did get involved in it. Now, alcoholism is rampant in my family tree. Oh, golly, it's rampant. I've got an aunt, Aunt Katie, that Shirley talked about this past Valentine's Day, picked up a 30-year chip. Her husband, Uncle James, God love him, he's at that big meeting in the sky right now. And if he'd have lived till this October, he'd have picked up a 30-year chip. And I got another uncle that's got 8 or 9 years. I got a younger brother that's got a little over 3 years and got several out there that are still working on their story. But I never was subjected to any of this at this time in my life. And I never was around any alcohol. And I never did drink. And I met Shirley, and we started dating, and Shirley didn't drink for totally different reasons. She didn't drink because she came out of that alcoholic broken home. But the point was that neither one of us drank. And we dated for 5 years, and we finally decided we were going to be able to get along, and we started talking about getting married, and we sat out and we started making specific plans, and two things basically came out of these talks. One, of course, was from Shirley, there's not going to be any drinking in our home. And the other was that we weren't going to divorce because by this time I came from divorced parents. And, of course, as Shirley shared with you today, you know why we're here this weekend? So you know that we've stood true to half of those two vows. But we made these vows, and then we were two kids, and we were madly in love, and we were ready to tackle the world, and we got married, and we set out on this great American dream. Now, let me tell you about this great American dream of ours. This great American dream consisted of both of us having good jobs and making good money so that we could buy nice things. so that when the neighbor up the street bought something a little nicer, we could run downtown, go in debt a little deeper, get something a little nicer, so we'd have to get a better job where we could make more money to buy nicer things. And our great American dream centered around something called the dollar bill. We had no idea, no conception of why we were here, what life was about. We just knew that success in life was tied to material things, and we were going to get them. And by golly, we were after them. We were good at it. We both had pretty good jobs, and we saved up enough money in a year to make that down payment on that first home out there in Hueytown. And then 3.5 years after we were married, God gave us the most beautiful blonde-headed, blue-eyed baby boy that a daddy could ever want. And Mike became a part of the great American dream. 17 months later, he gave us the most beautiful, healthy, brown-eyed baby girl that a daddy could ever want. And Sissy became a part of the great American dream. And we sat out and we took stock. And we had 2 kids and we had 2 cars and we had 2 jobs and we had a house. And everything we had was hocked to the hilt, and we were happy living the great American dream. And of course, this great American dream had to have 2 paychecks, so Shirley went back to work. She went back to work and was asked to join this social sorority. And she did. And it was at one of these social sorority dances on the Warrior River, not too far from Hueytown, one Saturday night in the summer, with the lights down low and the live band and the music soft and the kids at home tucked away with a babysitter. And I mixed my wife the first drink of alcohol that she was to ever have in her life. And I handed it to her and I said, "Here, drink this." And it wasn't too many years down the road that she was right up in my face. And she was telling me, "Bo, if you had never given me that drink, I wouldn't be the way I am today." And I didn't know anything about the disease of alcoholism. I just knew that our great American dream was coming apart. And it had all started falling apart when I gave her that drink. And so I agreed with her, and I accepted that guilt. And it was a load of guilt that was to get almost unbearable before I found you people, before I got to you. It was almost more than I could handle when I found you all. You know, I could stand up here and I could share with you war stories. And I love war stories. But I found out something about war stories over the last few years. If you take the names out and you take the times out and you take the places out, all our war stories are the same. They're the same. And I think they're the same because the pain is the same. We all hurt just alike. So rather than talk about war stories, what I'd like to do for a few minutes is just talk about some of the pain that was almost unbearable for me as a result of the disease of alcoholism in our family. And the first pain, the first feeling that I would talk to you about, of course, was that feeling of guilt that I was carrying. The guilt that I was the total cause, the total responsibility for my wife being the way she was. And it was to get unbearable, just almost unbearable. The next feeling that I would share with you, and I don't know about how many of you out there, but I'm just talking about me. It's a feeling called anger. Anger. Does anybody out there identify with that? I don't know about you, but let me tell you about me. On a good day, I got up angry and went to bed angry. And on a bad day, I got up angry and I went to bed in a blind, running rage. And toward the end of this thing, if you had set me down and tried to get it out of me, I probably couldn't have told you who or what I was angry at or about. I just knew I was angry. Just angry. Didn't know any other way to live. This feeling of self-pity. God, I was consumed with self-pity. You know, my prayers were, "Why me, God? And what have I done, God? And how could you let this happen to me, God?" Oh, the whole world was against me. Self-pity. Self-pity. A feeling of resentments. I was just eaten up with resentments, and I didn't know what a resentment was. I had a resentment at you if you were smiling. I had a resentment at you if your power never got turned off. I got a resentment at just anything and everything and everybody. This feeling of loneliness. Let me talk about that just a minute. I hear alcoholics talk about the loneliness of your disease, and I believe you. I don't argue that point a bit. But what I'd like to share with you is you don't have a corner on this thing called loneliness. We know about loneliness, too, and it doesn't have a darn thing in the world to do with how many people are in the room. You know, I can tell you this little story to illustrate what I'm talking about. Shirley was a kitchen drinker. She got off work at 4 o'clock. She was home at 4:30, and at 4:31, she had a drink in her hand. And this was just about a daily deal. I didn't get off work till 5 o'clock. So guess what I had to do every day at 4:45? I could not do it. I had to call. I had to call and see. And let me tell you, I could smell it over the telephone. I knew when she answered the phone. And of course, the deal was, if she had started drinking, which was usually the case, the way I handled it was I didn't go home. And at 5 o'clock when I got off, I'd go up the street to the local water hole with the guys from work. Now, I don't know about a lot of water holes, but I know about this one. Let me tell you about it. Had a big long bar, and down at the end of that bar was a big round table. And that's where all us guys from work gathered. We sat down there at that round table. And we'd gather down there every day, and I've never understood this. I just know this is the way it was. When you sat at the round table, you didn't just buy your own drinks. Everybody had to buy a round. Somebody would sit down and order a round, and then it'd move to the left, you see. And so every time somebody was ready for a drink, there was a round ordered. And I can't tell you how many afternoons, and this was most afternoons, that I'd be sitting up there, and there'd be two and three and four drinks lined up in front of me that had been ordered for me as they went around the table, and I wasn't going to drink them. And I would sit there, and the thought would go through my mind, Bo, why are you here? You've got a drink. You're sipping on it. You're not going to drink the rest of it. It's not the booze. Why are you here? It can't be the stories. You've heard every story that they've told 15 times. That's what we did. We recycled stories up there. So it can't be the stories. Why are you here? And then, of course, the realization would hit me, you're here because you can't go home. Your wife's home and she's drinking, and you can't stop it. You can't stop it. And then I would get to thinking, and I say, you know, these are the best friends I have in the world. These are the guys that I work with every day. And they really care about me. Maybe I should tell them what's going on, and maybe they could tell me something to try that I hadn't tried. But just as quickly, the red flag would go up and say, you dummy. You dummy, you can't tell them you've got a drunk wife at home because, you see, I was the only man on the face of the earth that had a drunk wife at home. And I couldn't tell you about it. And so I sat there in the middle of a crowded room, a crowded bar, at a table full of friends, and I stuffed it. And I was lonely, and I was isolated. Because I couldn't tell you about it. Couldn't tell you about it. And of course, I've just touched on another feeling, that feeling of failure. You see, that was the reason I couldn't go home. I was the head of the family. I was the husband. I was the father. And I was supposed to be able to take care of any problem that came up in our family. And I had been able to take care of most of the problems that came up as a result of it. I could take care of the bounce checks. I could take care of the family things that had to be changed. I could take care of the power that got turned off. I could take care of these things. I just couldn't take care of it. And so you see, I was a failure. I was a failure. Now somehow or another, it never occurred to me that I was at the top of my profession. The very top. I was as successful as I could be in my work life. I was totally active in fast-pitch softball, traveling all over the eastern United States in semi-pro fast-pitch softball. And I was a success in that area of my life. But you see, those things got overshadowed, and I could not get a feeling of success of anything because I was a failure where my wife was concerned. And so I was a failure in all areas of my life. a total failure. This disease made me one of the most proficient liars that there is in Jefferson County, Alabama. Now, I wasn't raised to be a liar. I was raised in that church, and I was taught the difference between right and wrong, and I was taught the difference between telling the truth and not telling the truth. But you see, I had gotten to the point that I could lie, and I could make it okay. It was all right to tell the lie. An example, this lady at Alabama Power Company, that's the electric company there where we live, and somehow or another, we just never could keep the power bill paid. And the power, you know, it just, about every 2 months, this lady would call me. And it had gotten to the point that we had formed this relationship on the phone. She didn't call and ask for Mr. Templin. She'd call and say, let me speak to Bo. We were on a first-name basis. And she'd get me on the phone and she'd say, Bo, your power bill hadn't been paid in 2 months, honey. And if we don't get it by 3 o'clock this afternoon, we're going to turn your power off. And I'd kick in. Now, let me tell you about my lying, how I kicked in. First thing I did when I kicked in was the smile came. When that smile came, I was fixing to lay something on you. Now, here I am talking to this lady on the phone, but the smile kicks in. And I said, you know, it's funny you should call me today. And this, we did this over and over again. Funny you should call me today. Shirley just told me last night that she hadn't paid the power bill. And I stopped on the way to work this morning and I put you a check in the mail. Now, there's no need for you to turn the power off. You wait till 8 o'clock in the morning, open the mail, the check's there. Everything will be fine. And that lady would let me by with that. But you see, Shirley hadn't told me. And I hadn't mailed a check. And if I had, it would have bounced. If there'd been any money there, Shirley would have paid it. But this gave me till 8 o'clock the next morning to go to brother or to go to uncle or to go to mother, get the money, and be down there when they opened up and pay the power bill and keep the power from being turned off. Now, it was okay to do that, you see, because of the kids. The kids had homework to do. The kid had, they had baths to take. They had, food had to be cooked. We had to take care of the children. And so that's the reason it was okay to tell that lie. You know, I got in this program, and after being around this program a while, and got me a sponsor. And I was sitting down talking with my sponsor one day, and we were discussing this. And my sponsor looked at me and said, Bo, was there ever a time that you couldn't get the money? And I said, why, sure, several times. Well, what happened? I said, well, they turned the power off. Fran said, well, what'd you do? I said, well, we did what any great American family living the great American dream would do. We pulled out that plastic card, that money that you don't have, and we told the kids to pack a bag, and we went down to the Holiday Inn or the Days Inn, and we stayed down there a day or two until I could get the money and get the power bill paid and get it turned back home. So Fran said, then the kids never did hurt. And I said, no, really and truly, the kids never did without. She said, well, why do you reckon you had to tell that lie? Now, let me tell you why I had to tell that lie. In Hueytown, Alabama, when Alabama Power turns your power off, they got this red tag about this wide and about this long. And it says on this bright red tag, we have turned your power off because you ain't paid your bill. And when you bring us, and they got this big blank space there where they can write in a lot of numbers. When you bring us $482 or whatever it was, then we'll come turn your power back on. And of course, what they did was they would turn your power off and then they hung that right on your front doorknob. And that was the reason I had to tell that lie. Because you see, if they turned that power off and hung that tag on our front door, if you lived up the street from me, if you were one of my neighbors, then you would know. And we couldn't let you know. We had to keep it hid. See, we were four people living four separate lives under one roof. But the deal, the rule was, right before you hit that door to go outside, you stopped and you straightened up and you put the smile on. And when you hit the front door, everything was fine. Everything was fine. And that's the reason I had to tell that lie. I couldn't let you know that things weren't okay in our home. This aunt that we've talked about that's got this 30-year sobriety, she had around 18, 19-year sobriety, and she called me at work one day. And she said, "Bo, how are you handling things out there?" And first thing that happened was the smile came. So you know what I've been to do. And the smile came, and I said, "Oh, Aunt Katie, we're just doing fine." She said, "No, you ain't, honey. And I ain't going to listen to it. I want to know what's going on out there." And I said, "Well, Aunt Katie, let me tell you what me and the kids are doing." And I said, "Well, we're really tickled about this." I said, "You know, Sharna comes home from work, and she starts drinking, and she'll drink till 8, 8:30, 9 o'clock, whatever, how much it takes. She'll drink till she passes out every night." And I said, "When she passes out every night," I said, "then the kids and I meet, and we have a little short session to talk over what went on that day." And I said, "Then we go on our witch hunt." And I said, "We've been going, and we've been going in the kitchen, and we've been finding all our booze." And I said, "Aunt Katie, we go in there every night, and we find it, and we pour it out, and we throw the bottles away." And Aunt Katie just started chuckling real sweetly on the other end of the phone. She said, "Honey, I didn't know you were that well off financially." And you see, I didn't understand her. I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "Well, what does Shirley do the next day on the way home from work?" I said, "Well, she stops and buys more." And it dawned on me. Aunt Katie said, "Bo, let her do what she's got to do. We're watching her. We're ready for her. Just let her do what she's got to do." And I told Aunt Katie, I said, "Aunt Katie, I appreciate you enlightening me on this, and I'll change." And I did change. It's 2.5 years before my wife went into treatment. Now, I never did stop pouring her booze out. I got to be honest with you, I poured that gal's booze out till the day she went into treatment. I know today I did it because I had to. I couldn't not do it. But here's what I changed. The kids and I still met, and we still went on the witch hunts. And we still found all her booze and pulled it out of her hiding places, and I still poured it out. But instead of throwing the bottles away, I set them empties up on the drain board of the sink. And see, I was sending a message to her when she got up the next morning, walked in the kitchen, saw them empties. I was sending the message. See here, we found it, and we poured it out. Now, that tell you a little bit about where communication had gotten to in our home. See, we were just sending messages. That's all we were capable of doing, was just sending messages. I sent that message for 2.5 years. Shirley was in that treatment center, and we were sitting up there one day, and we were talking, and this subject came up, and I told this story, and Shirley's mouth dropped wide open. She said, "My God, Bo, for the last 2.5 years, I've walked in the kitchen just about every morning and looked and said, 'You dummy, you blacked out and drank it all again.'" She never even knew. She never even knew. Let me tell you, our family was just like your family. As long as drinking continued, things got worse. And I continued to dedicate my life to getting my wife sober. And I never could push the right button or find the right thing to do. And then that day came in July, late July 1982, that the kids and I were going to a ball game. And it had been a long time since we'd asked Shirley to go to a ball game with us. And I think it had been a long time since she had wanted to go. Because, you see, we'd be gone for 3 or 4 hours, and this would give her 3 or 4 hours to do what she had to do without us standing over her. But as we got ready to leave that night, Mike, who was 15 at that time, turned and looked at his mom. They said, "Mom, when we get home tonight, will you be passed out on the floor, passed out on the couch, or passed out in bed?" You see, we never know what it is that's going to trigger them. We just never know. And as Shirley told you, that statement just burned through. Absolutely burned through to the core of her being. How dare this young man not respect his mother any more than that? And Mike didn't wait for an answer. He just walked on out, and we got in the car, and we went to the ball game. When we got home that night and we drove in the driveway, I knew that something was different because it was well past her passing out time and she was still up. And we walked in and she was not drunk. She had been drinking, but she was not drunk. And she met us at the door. And she told me, she said, "Bo, I've called a treatment center. I got to do something about my drinking, and I've called a treatment center." And I looked at her and I said, "Shirley, you know, this is number 1,382. What's different this time?" And I took a shower and I went to bed. I didn't believe her. And it was the next day at work when this treatment center called me for some insurance information that I really believed that my wife had called. Now let me tell you, God was taking care of us then, and we did not have any idea that God even knew we were around. Because God directed us to a treatment center that believes wholeheartedly in treating alcoholism as a family disease. They believe wholeheartedly in the 12-step programs of AA, Al-Anon, and Alateen. And there were some treatment centers in our area at that time that didn't view it that way. And we didn't know the difference. And God sent us where we needed to be. And we made the arrangements and we loaded up, and I'm sure that was quite a sight as we loaded up the pickup truck that day. And the kids with two lounge chairs and a cooler full of Pepsi and their blaster radio, and Mom and Dad up front, and off to treatment we go. Fully intending to take Shirley up there and leave her for the 28 days and go back and get her, and she would be okay. And we could go on about living the great American dream. And when we got up there to drop her off, this counselor said, "I'd like to talk to you for just a minute before you leave." And so we got Shirley kind of processed in, and then this counselor came over and he said, "You know, we have something up here called Family Week. It's going to happen 2 or 3 weeks from now." And he said, "Your kids are old enough that we'd like for you to bring both kids." And he said, "It's where we're going to ask you to come up and stay Monday to Friday and be a part of the treatment process." And he said, "But I'm not going to go into a lot of detail right now. I just wanted to make you aware of it. And we'll send you a letter that will explain it to you." And we left and we went out and we got in the truck and the kids are up front with me. And the kids are a little bit upset. They say, "Oh, Dad, we don't know about this thing going up there." Because, see, this would happen in the month of August. And they were out of school on summer vacation. And they kind of scoped this place out while we were up there. And as pretty as this place was, back in this valley, as pretty as it was, there was no swimming pool. And there were no TVs. And they had even found out that they didn't have Cokes up there. All they had was fruit juice. And the kids were said, "Dad, I don't know. We don't know about this." And I said, whoa, kids, settle down. "Well, we're not going up there. We're not going up there for that, but we have no reason to go. You see, they've got your mom, and that's our problem, and we'll leave her up there. I was just being nice to that guy. It's his job to try to get me to come. So don't you worry, we're not going." And we went on home. About a week later, this letter comes in the mail, and I open up this letter, and it's telling me about this thing called Family Week. And there was a statement that literally jumped off the page. And the statement said, "We want you to come up here and stay for 5 days and learn how to live with your alcoholic." Now, that made sense to me. And I called the kids in, and I read the letter to them, and I put an emphasis on this statement. And I said, "Kids, we better go." Because I said, "What's going to happen? We're going to go up there, and they're going to teach us how to keep her sober. And we need this education. There's going to be certain things that we can do and certain things that we can't do, and some things that absolutely must be done, and we need to know what they are." And then as we continued to talk about it, we realized both kids were out of school, so it would be real no inconvenience for them. We had darn good insurance that was going to pay for every bit of it. I was like any good untreated Al-Anon. I had 6 years of unused vacation time. So there was no reason for us to not go. And we loaded up and we went up to the treatment center for Family Week. Now, I'm going to tell you just a little bit about Family Week, and Shirley and Sissy are both correct. They call it Family Week, and we call it Hell Week, because it was. It was. We had not been on the ground 15 minutes till I was already mad. Because we got there, and we walked in with our bags, and they directed my daughter down to the end of the hall and put her in a room with a lady that I had never met before. See, there was 18 of us family members up there for about 6 different patients. And they sent my son down at the end of the hall and put him in the room with a man that I had never met before. And I told them right up front that I did not approve of this. And they told me right up front that it would not be changed. To get my bags unpacked, that we were due upstairs in a group room in 15 minutes. And so I unpacked and I went up to this group room. And I had not been in my first group session 5 minutes till I was in a standing up shouting argument with the counselor. And I don't know how bad it was showing on me. I just know that he started with me. And let me tell you what we were arguing about. We were arguing about the fact that he asked me something about me. And I told him it was none of his business. That we were not there about me. That we were there about her. And I'd be glad to tell him anything he wanted to know about her. And that's when he began to tell me. He said, no, Bo. He said, Family Week is about giving you an opportunity to see how you have been affected by the disease of alcoholism and to show you how you can get into a recovery program for yourself. He said, that's what this week's about. It's about you. And I looked at him and I said, if that's what it's about, and I pulled the letter out on him. I said, then you lied to me in this letter. Now, there's I think, 18 of us family members in that room. Every one of those got a copy of this letter, just like mine, and he wrote it. But I read it to him. And I said, if we're up here about me, then you lied to me in this letter. And Mike looked at me with a big grin on his face across that room, and he said, you're darn right, Bo, I lied to you. I lied to you. He said, but what would you have done if I'd have sent you a letter and said, you've been affected and your kids have been affected by this disease and you need help too? And I didn't have to answer him. You know what I'd have done? I'd have thrown the letter away and I wouldn't have gone. Thank God he lied to me in that letter to get me there. Because let me tell you the first thing that I remember happening that was positive for me up there. The first thing that I remember happening was they began to tell me that my wife had a disease. That alcoholism was a disease. And that if it's a disease, then there was 3 C's that I needed to get in contact with. That I didn't cause it, I can't control it, and I darn sure can't cure it. And you see, I needed to hear that. I was pretty in touch with it. I couldn't control it, and I couldn't cure it. What I needed to hear was that I didn't cause it. Because you know what I took up there with me? I took that load of guilt that was just about to break me in two. And this was the very beginning of me being able to shed that load of guilt. And when I learned that my wife had a disease, then it became very clear to me that way back down there many years before, on the Warrior River at that sorority party, when I handed her that drink, I introduced my wife to alcohol, not alcoholism. And I was not responsible for her having the disease of alcoholism. The next thing that happened up there that was important for me is that gal came up there one night and brought us an Al-Anon meeting up there. Yeah, brought us an Al-Anon meeting. And there was all 18 of us family members was in this Al-Anon meeting that night. But I don't remember her talking to anybody else in the room. But if she's going to stay sober, she's going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, period. If she's going to stay sober, she's going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, period. She said, if you want to regain any of your sanity and begin to experience any serenity in your life, you're going to go to Al-Anon, period. No, I hope you do. No choices, no options. If you want it, this is where you're going to go get it. Period. And she said, I certainly hope that you go. And she said, if you do, she said, there's a couple of things I want you to do. She said, I want you to go to every meeting you go to at least 30 minutes early and be prepared to stay at least 30 minutes late. Because she said, I want you to go to every meeting you go to with an open mind, with open ears, with open heart, with a positive attitude, looking for something that's going to help you in your recovery. And she said, if you go in that frame of mind, you'll get something. But it may not be said right during the meeting. It may be said during the fellowship before or after. And you don't want to miss it. You don't want to miss it. So she said, go early and be prepared to stay late. And she said, when you get there, you pick you out a winner. And until the fog can clear and you can get your head screwed back on a little straight, you do everything this winner does. If that winner goes to get a cup of coffee, you go get a cup of coffee. Because winners talk at the coffee pot and you don't want to miss what she's going to say. And that's the advice I was given as I was shoved toward the doors of Al-Anon. My wife got out of this treatment center. And we went to this anniversary in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, the Tuscaloosa AA and Al-Anon anniversary, the very first night that my wife was out of treatment. And when we came back home from that, we sat down in the middle of the floor, all four of us, and we talked about something called family recovery. And we talked about we wanted to try it, that we wanted to make the effort, that we were willing to work for it. We wanted to put it back together. And we asked the kids to go to four Alateen meetings, and then they could make a decision about whether they thought Alateen was for them or not. Cynthia went to those four and just absolutely fell in love with it. She found her place. And of course, you know, if you heard her story, she stayed there for 7 years and now has been in Al-Anon for 3 years. Beautiful, beautiful young lady. Mike went to those meetings and came back home and sat down and he said, I don't think it's for me. He was 15 years old, he was blonde-headed, he was blue-eyed, he was good-looking, he had a motorcycle, and he had some chasing to do. Yeah, and I think he did some catching, too. And that was okay. That was all right. Because you see, like Shirley said today, Mike had a program, too. Mike had a program because he lived in a home where the program is practiced. You betcha. You betcha. And we started out on this journey, this thing called family recovery. But here's the deal. My wife was real serious about her sobriety. She was dedicated to her sobriety. And she was out there in that AA room, and she had her a sponsor, and she was reading her big book, and she was working 12 steps, and she was praying, and she was establishing a conscious contact with God, and she was getting better. And I was sitting over in the Al-Anon rooms, and I didn't need your steps, and I didn't need to pray, and I didn't need a sponsor, and I didn't need any of this stuff because my wife was in the other room, and she was sober. And she was sober. And the first 6 months, I was just around this program in that condition. Because you see, I came here full of confusion and full of despair and this feeling of failure and full of anger and resentment and self-pity with a big smile on my face telling you I was fine, thank you. I was fine. And I sat in your meetings and I laughed with you. But I wasn't doing anything about a program. I was just around it. I wasn't in it. And the result was my wife got better and I wasn't getting any better and we were getting farther apart in recovery. Farther apart. And this went on for about 6 months. And finally I came home from one of those meetings one night where there'd been another big discussion and disagreement. And I know tonight that I was the cause of that disagreement, my ignorance and my ego. And I came home and I sat down and I looked at Shirley and I told her, I said, Shirley, I see you getting better and I see you growing and I see you feeling better about yourself and I ain't getting any better. Tell me what to do. My wife didn't try to fix me. She looked at me and she said, Bo, I can tell you what I'm doing. And she said, I suggest that you go to Bessemer Al-Anon tomorrow night and you make that your home group and you get you a sponsor and you start doing some of these things. And so I went to Bessemer Al-Anon the next night and I sat through that meeting. And when that meeting was over, I went up to one of these gals that I had long before identified as a winner. You see, there were no other guys in the group. There wasn't a guy for me to go to. And I went up to this gal and I grabbed Fran, and a lot of y'all in this room know Fran. And I grabbed Fran and I said, Fran, I got to have a sponsor. Will you be my sponsor? She had a temporary lapse of sanity and agreed to. But Fran put a condition on it. She said, Bo, I'm willing to sponsor you if you're willing to go to work. And I said, go to work. Say, go to work meant being up front, chairing the meetings, picking the speakers. Oh, in charge. Yeah, working toward being president of this thing. But Fran had already seen through me, you see, and she said, no, Bo, that's not what I'm talking about. And I said, what are you talking about? And she said, I'm willing to sponsor you if you're willing to go to work on you. And I said, how do I do that? And she said, honey, we got 12 steps to take care of that. And if you're willing today to make a conscious commitment to start trying to work these steps in your life on a daily basis, she said, then I'm ready to take you by the hand and walk with you. It's been 9 years, almost 9.5 years, and that gal's still walking with me. Still walking with me. Thank God for sponsors. Thank God for sponsors. It wasn't too long in this relationship till Fran and I realized that I was going to need a male in this relationship too. And my gal looked at me and she said, Bo, you need to go get you an AA that's working 12 steps. There's no Al-Anons around, no male Al-Anons. Let's get you an AA that's working 12 steps. Well, I just happened to pick the one that's lived with her for about 45 years. Yeah. And we brought Jim into this relationship. And Jim and Fran have been there. They've been there for us. And I began to start trying to work these steps and I began to get a little bit better. And then the time came, of course, when I decided on my own that it was time for me to work the fourth step to do an inventory. I didn't find it necessary to talk to Jim and Fran about this and ask for their input. I just started writing my fourth step. And I started having all kind of problems, and I fought this thing and wrestled with it for a few days. And then I made the phone call, and I said, I need to come by and see you. And this didn't surprise them at all. And they said, come on by. And I walked in over there that afternoon, and I looked at him, and I said, you know, I've been trying to write this inventory, and I'm having all kind of problems. And Fran looked at me and said, sure, you're having problems. And I said, how is it that you're so smart? I said, you didn't even know I was trying to do it. She said, Bo, if you're trying to do a four step, you've got to be having problems because you ain't through with the third step. Yeah. She said, you still got God judging you. You still got a God that's going to get you. And she said, you got to do something about God as you understand him. And she was right. She was right. And Jim said, Bo, I'd like to take you into the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'm one of those Al-Anons that believes in reading and studying the textbook Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't apologize for that from the podium. But I do want to explain it. I did not say put down your Al-Anon literature. Okay, don't hear something I didn't say. I said find some extra time and get you a copy of the textbook Alcoholics Anonymous and read and study it. Mighty powerful stuff in there. Two chapters in there we ought to be studying real regular anyhow because they were written for us. Jim took me into the chapter to the agnostic in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. And we did some reading, and we did some studying, and we did some sharing. And it was in that chapter that I found my conception of God that worked for me then, and it's working for me today. And in there it tells about a minister's son who's having a spiritual experience, and he's having a few problems with this. His intellect's getting in the way. And I can't quote it, but it says he fell to his knees. And he said, God, if there is a God, help me. And he said, immediately he was surrounded by the presence of infinite power and love. God, what a conception of God. Infinite, that's never ending. never-ending power, never-ending love, available to me 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. When I tap into it, I got to take the action. I got to tap in. And it says he had stepped from the bridge to the shore, and he stood in conscious companionship with his Creator. And I didn't understand that part about stepping from the bridge to the shore. And so my man Jim was able to carry me back into the chapter and show me where it's explained. Some of us have already stepped far over the bridge of reason to the desired shore of faith. Now let me tell you what that meant to me. When I read that and it said some of us have already stepped far over the bridge of reason to the desired shore of faith, what that meant to this Al-Anon was I could step out of understanding. Reason is understanding. I could get out of understanding and I could step into acceptance. Acceptance. God, was that to be proof so, so meaningful to me just a few years down the road, because some things were going to happen in my life that I did not understand then and do not understand today. But with faith in a loving and kind and forgiving God, I'm learning to accept them, you see. Out of understanding into acceptance. And so I had my new conception of God and I was ready to go on in these steps, I thought. But you see, I really wasn't ready yet. And God worked with me at that point just like he always works with me. He just allowed me to get more and more miserable. And I got up one Wednesday morning, and I looked at Shirley, and I said, Shirley, I don't want to go to work today. And she said, gosh, why don't you take a day off and stay home? And I said, heck, I don't want to stay home. And she said, what is it you want to do, Bo? And I said, I want to get away from me. And you see, I was totally, totally miserable with me, because what was happening in my life was I was fighting God. I was fighting God. And I finally decided that I'd go on to work. I could be miserable there and get paid for it. And I started to work that Wednesday morning, and I remember just like it was yesterday. I pulled my truck off out of traffic on the busiest street in Bessemer, Alabama. And I sat there, and I beat on that steering wheel, and I hollered at God. I just hollered at God. And I said, God, I don't know what we're going to do. And I don't know where we're going to go. And I don't even know what it is I got that you might use, God, but whatever it is, today you have it. Today you have it. I'm giving it to you, God. I can't handle it anymore. And if that emotional turmoil that I had been carrying, if that fear and that despair and that feeling of impending doom that was so big in me, if all of those things could have been water, they'd have made a puddle around my feet as I felt them drain. And you see, what I know today is that right there, in my own words, in my own way, I took the third step prayer. God, relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. That's what I did. And I gave it to him. I also know that what I did that morning was that I fired Bo as general manager of Bo's life. I'd run it in the ditch. And I fired Bo as general manager of Bo's life. And I looked around, and the best general manager available then and the best general manager available today is God. And I hired him. And today, as long as I can keep Bo fired and God hired, we do okay. We do all right. And that's pretty much what it's about today, is keeping Bo fired, God hired. Things really begin to get better then, and we're running way out of time. But I want to share with you just a few things that have come to me as a result of being able to get involved in this program and take some action and do some things that you have directed me to do. Some of the rewards that I've gotten from this program. And the first thing that I'd share with you that's been given to me in this program is freedom. Freedom. Freedom from that guilt. Freedom from that anger. Freedom from those resentments. Freedom from worry. That feeling of self-pity. It's not that these feelings don't crop back up in my life, because they do. They crop back up in the form of daily living problems. But the freedom I have today is the freedom of choice of whether they stay or not. Or whether I get with you and I work through them and I do something about them and get rid of them. The freedom of choice. The second thing that I'd share with you that this program's given me is it's given me hope. That's our message anyhow, isn't it? Hope. It ain't as good as it's going to be, but it's a darn sight better than it was. Yeah. This program has given me that new concept of God that I've already shared with you. Let me tell you, though, this program also gave me back to me. When I got here, I didn't know who I was. I didn't know what I was. I didn't know what my life was about. And today, with your help, I'm beginning to get a little handle on who I am and what I am and what direction my life might be going. But you know, I'm not only learning today what I am, I'm learning what I am not. And I think that's even as important, because I've come to the realization that I don't have to be all things to all people anymore. All I got to be is the best me that I can be today. But I think probably the most important thing, by far, that this program has given me is it's given me you. It's given me you. Because see, I'm like that little frightened child. And the mom has taken the child upstairs and has put the child in bed and tucked the child in. And they've said the prayers. And the little child is there to go to sleep. And mama goes downstairs and the storm starts. Yeah. And the rain begins to beat on the side of the house, and the wind is blowing, and the leaves, the limbs are scraping on the side of the house, and there's lightning and there's thunder, and it's a bad storm, and the child gets scared and the child starts to cry. And the mother goes back upstairs and goes into the bedroom and sits down on the edge of the bed and is soothing the child and settling the child down and said, "Honey, you know that God loves you. And we've taken you to church and you've learned about God and you know that you're one of God's children and God loves you and that God's going to take care of you and you're going to be safe." And the little child looks up and says, "Yeah, Mom, yeah, I know about God. And I know that God loves me and I know that God's going to protect me. But tonight, Mom, just tonight, I need somebody with skin on them." Yeah. And God knew that about me. He knew that I was going to need somebody with skin on him, so he sent me to you and sent you to me. Because you see, the day came when we had to open that door and we had to look at those three policemen that told us that our 20-year-old son had just been killed by a drunk driver. And immediately, I was right back to, "Why me, God? How could you do this to me, God? What's the deal, God? What's this all about?" You know, I remember going to the telephone and I called my mom. And I told her what had happened and she said, "I'll call your brother and sister and we'll be over as quickly as possible." And the next phone call I made was to my sponsor. And I told my sponsor what had happened. And I can remember my sponsor saying to me, "Bo, you got to hang up the phone." And I said, "Friend, I don't want to hang up this phone." Because see, I had her voice on the other end of it. And she said, "Honey, you've got to hang up the phone." And I said, "Why?" And she said, "We can't come to you as long as we're talking to you on the phone." And she didn't tell me, "Pray about it and we'll talk tomorrow." She didn't tell me, "Read page so-and-so and I'll see you tomorrow." She said, "Hang up the phone where I can come to you." And that's what this program did. You came to us. You came to us. Within 30 to 45 minutes, AA and Al-Anon and Al-Ateen was in our home, and you did not leave us. You did not leave us. There was a period of time right there that we were incapable of making a decision. But we didn't have to, because you were there and you made the decisions for us. And there was a period of time there that I was incapable of praying. I was so mad at God that I was incapable of praying. But that's okay. Did you see, the time came in my life when I did not have a prayer, and you prayed for me. You prayed for me. That's what this problem's about, people. That's what this problem's about. Let me tell you about Mike. Mike was killed on a Tuesday night. The last time I saw my boy alive was about 7 o'clock Tuesday morning as he was leaving the house to go to work. He stopped by my chair where I was sitting there with a cup of coffee. And he stopped and he patted me on the shoulder. He said, "I'm going to work, Dad." And he said, "I love you, Dad." It's the last words I heard my son speak. "I love you, Dad." You know where we got that? Got that from y'all. Y'all taught us how to live that way. Y'all gave us that gift as you helped us to put our family back together. And let me tell you, when he left the house that morning, I didn't think anything about it because that was a normal daily deal. That was not out of the ordinary. That's the way we were living because you had taught us to live that way. Thank God for these programs. Thank God. Thursday night. Mike's funeral's on Friday morning. Thursday night, we're standing in the funeral hall. And the line's all the way out. They got him in the chapel in the biggest room they got. The line's all the way out the door, out the back, and up the sidewalk. I don't tell you this to brag. I tell you to tell you about what this way of life's about. People were standing in line for 45 minutes. To get up there and hug Shirley and I's neck and Sissy. And we're standing up there Thursday night and we look down there in that line. And there's an OAA from College Park, Georgia, sitting right back here in Bessemer, Alabama, standing in that line. Lester was there. That's what this program's about. That's what it's about. I don't know. My simple mind is not capable of comprehending the power of this way of life. The power of what we're involved in. Newcomer, if you're sitting out there, let me tell you, you're in the right place. You're in the right place. We've looked out there too long for the answer. The answer's here. And you're where you belong. You're fixing to tap something that's beyond your wildest imagination. I don't know how powerful this way of life is, but I can tell you this much. There's a real live alcoholic sitting right back yonder that has been able so far to today to walk through this pain of losing her son. And she has not had to take a drink. And I suggest to you that is by God powerful. That is powerful. And there's a real live Al-Anon standing in front of you tonight that so far has not had to load the shotgun and go do something totally insane. And I planned it. I planned it. I had it planned to the finest detail, but guess what? You showed up. You showed up and you recognized it in me and you sat me down and you talked to me. And you wouldn't allow me to go do it. You made that decision for me. So as I bring this thing to a head and a close, I hope that you understand just how important you are to me. Just how vital you are to my very survival. I gotta have you. I got to have you. And with that in mind, I want to close by making this deal with you. Now that you understand just how important you are to me, Here's the deal. I'm going to keep coming back to rooms just like this, full of people just like you. And the deal is, I want you to keep coming back. And if I keep coming back, and you keep coming back, then I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that sooner or later, our paths will cross again as we trudge this road to a happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you so much for having me.